Hello, John from the Lib Dem podcast here. We are delighted to say that this episode is sponsored by Prater Rains. Now more than ever, you need a professional looking online presence and website. Prater Rains have been helping Liberal Democrat campaigns succeed for 18 years. Their Lib Dem Foci package combines a website, social media and email system to help Lib Dems win. You'll receive great support from real people, fair pricing and a huge range of features to choose from. Prater Rains are already the bespoke developers for Lighthouse, Lib Dem Draw Online and the LD Directory. They combine a talented system design with an unrivalled understanding of our party, our data and our systems. To find out more, check out the Prater Rains website at praterrains.co.uk/liberal-democrats. Now, on with the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Lib Dem podcast. And as we record on Friday, it looks like we might have a new president of the United States. Everyone hopefully still got their fingers crossed. There might be one less racist leader in the world. We will obviously invite President-elect Biden to come on the podcast. We're not sure if he's going to make it because, you know, he does like to sleep. But we will got loads of stuff to discuss today. So my name is John Potter. With us, we have the two originals. Of course, we have Richard Kemp, leader of the Liverpool Lib Dems. Hi, Richard. And we have our longest standing guest who now became a regular because she was so good. Welcome, Lisa Smart from Stockport.
Good to see you, John.
Right, so we should touch very quickly about the US elections. We are going to do a special podcast on it anyway, but it looks like, as of right now, that Biden is going to win. You know, he's ahead in Pennsylvania, which is going to win it. Any thoughts other than what a disgrace Trump is being in terms of taking the result? I mean, I think, Richard, when we were talking before the results started coming in, I said he might act like a jilted ex-lover. He's gone to full-on dictator. So what are your quick thoughts, Richard?
I don't think he has, actually, because I think he's become increasingly just a sad, sad figure. Unfortunately, the sad, sad figure can incite a hell of a lot of problems. And he seems to be saying things today, get out on the street to defend democracy. Well, when you and I say that, that means go and deliver another leaflet. I think when he says it, some people will be considering whether or not they ought to take to the street with guns. But I thought the most interesting point was it last night or the night before? You lose track of these things now, when most of the press channels just turned off after a few minutes, 13 minutes of diatribes about absolute rubbish of unsubstantiated allegations, and the press went, enough. And I think that's the turning point. If Biden is declared tonight, what he says will be irrelevant. And it looks as though he's going to win by at least three states, what the point of all these legal suits are, because he can't overturn the results in three states. So I think it's Biden's, and a very sad man will probably end up in prison for some of the things he's done. If not, he'll end up in bankruptcy.
Donald Trump tends to threaten more lawsuits than he actually goes through with. But actually, and Lisa, you can have the final say in this, it was actually not a bad night for the Republicans, actually. If you look at, you know, they kept the Senate, they won a governorship, they actually took seats from the Democrats in the House, not enough to control the House. But it is interesting, it seems that people seem to have liked the Republicans, but not liked Donald Trump, which is, you know, I think we can all agree, very understandable.
Yeah, I think it's easy for us to try and draw comparisons from the US election system and the way US campaigners campaign and try and draw some comparisons for us over here. I think what's clear, although not all the votes have been counted, is the importance of targeting, and so focusing your effort on those places where it makes the most difference. There's absolutely no point running up massive tallies where you've already won or equally where you've already lost. I think it's those key battleground states that are flipping and the ones that are still counting, those Great Lakes states and those Midwest states, are where to focus the efforts. And the other thing is the importance of the ground game. You can get all the support in the world, but if people don't vote, then it doesn't count. It's only the votes that get actually cast that count. And so the importance of lots of people talking about Stacey Abrams and the voter registration drive that she oversaw and the impact of that in Georgia. And yes, you need to get voters on the register, but you need to get them to vote as well, and the impact of postal votes. And I think that is a lesson that I hope Lib Dems listening to this will draw. It's the importance of postal votes to elections, but particularly postal votes to elections during a global pandemic.
Absolutely.
I have already followed your instructions, which you emailed all of us. And I've been out twice. I've done other things today, which I'll talk about later. I've been out twice today with postal vote letters. We're delivering them to all our D's and P's and other people in our strongest areas, because I think you're right. So two messages. I'm glad you've reinforced them there. Get out, don't stop delivering, and get out and make sure the postal vote comes up as high as possible, because I think no matter what happens, people are going to be a bit reluctant to vote next May.
Being the consummate professional that Richard is, he has perfectly segued from the American elections to Britain, because obviously the reason why Lisa has said that advice is because Britain has gone into its new lockdown.
And England,
beg your pardon, that is quite true. Wales have come out of theirs, Scotland don't know what they're doing yet. And so England has gone into its second lockdown. I suppose, from my instinct, it doesn't seem as harsh as what happened in March, in terms of there seems to be a lot less people taking it, a lot less stringent. So it feels a bit like, because someone like in Preston, where we've been under measures for a long time, it feels like pretty similar measures, but the pubs and restaurants are closed. That's kind of what it feels like to me. But I mean, Richard, you obviously are the leader of the Liverpool Lib Dems. Liverpool has been selected as the test site for a citywide testing kind of pilot. So do you want to talk about a little bit how that's come about and what the impressions of that are now?
Yes, I mean, it came about because at the beginning of October, we had the highest infection rate of any city in the country, not city region. There are places, core cities. There are other places that had higher ones. We know Blackburn, for example, is a very difficult example. We have been working very strongly, and we've been doing it with Labour, so there's been no political divide between us, to bring the numbers down. So as of today, our infection rates are half what they were on the 7th of October. So that's real progress, but we need to finish it off. So the discussions took place over the weekend. The government were looking for somewhere to trial a total approach. Liverpool, I think, whether you agree with it or not, had been very supportive of moving, first of all, to a tier three status. And we have been asking for a lockdown right from the start, again, unitedly across the political parties. So it was announced on Monday that the army would come in. Now, that's created some panic in Liverpool. It's the Tories coming in to do it. Once you get the army off the streets, you'll never get them in. Mass testing is only about harvesting your DNA. But what I saw today when I went with the mayor of Liverpool, we both agreed that we'd be tested together, was queues of Scousers coming to do their bit for the community. Because if they know they're safe, that's great. If they know that they're not safe, these were people who would clearly self-isolate and stop that infection going. So by Monday, we'll have 85 sites going, and we implore everyone who lives and works in Liverpool to go for it. And it's not a very nice test, because they give you this stick, and a cotton bud thing, and you wave it around either side of your tonsils, then you shove it up your nose. So it's not very pleasant, but it only lasts 30 seconds. And within 2 hours, I got my quick result, which is negative. And within 24 hours, I'll get my longer result. They send, you do it twice in my case, and they send it off somewhere else. So I can tell you as of now, I'm negative, and that the people of Liverpool are responding to this request.
Lisa, what's your impression of the politics of it? I mean, because it was obviously a huge U-turn. It was very similar to the first one in terms of that it seemed to happen much later than obviously the scientists had been calling for, what we had been calling for, and then what Labour had been calling for. Are you surprised that the government did it? Are you surprised? Is it because they seem desperate not to? And obviously, MP who you challenged, I think, obviously voted against the lockdown measures, we noticed. So there's definitely a kind of internal tug of war here within the Tories about it.
That's right. And it's for all sorts of different political reasons. So I think some people who don't think a lockdown is the right answer necessarily, it's because the evidence of what the impact of the measures isn't clear. I think the other thing, the lockdown will only work if test, trace and isolate actually does what it's supposed to do. And some data came out today or yesterday, which showed the lowest percentage of contacts reached for the Serco test and trace on record. And it's just, if that doesn't work, the whole of the system falls down. I think we in Greater Manchester, also having been in tier three and in not dissimilar lockdown measures for quite a long time, are watching what's going on in Liverpool with real interest, because I think one of the ways lots of people are hoping we get out of this while we wait for a vaccine or vaccines to get to where they need to be is a proper testing, is mass testing is one way out of this. So we're watching with real interest. My worry, apart from the obvious health concerns that we have, is the impact on our most vulnerable. I think I'm sure those of you who are councillors will have had lots and lots of casework from people about visiting relatives in care homes, as one example, and how you just can't, if you've got a relative who, say, who's living with dementia, and you're their main family member or their main point of contact, that must be so distressing, both for the relative who's in the care home and those people hoping to visit them. That's one item. The other things are, you know, kids not being fed over school holidays, which we might talk a little bit more about as time goes on. But it's the impact of these measures on people with businesses, people who are losing their jobs, and the most vulnerable in our society that I worry about the most.
And we're glad Laura's joined us. Hi, Laura. So we're obviously talking about lockdown. And I suppose the worry I have, and I wonder what your position is, Laura, is that I'm not sure if, Lisa's just alluded to, the test and trace system isn't yet working anywhere near where it needs to be. So any benefits we gain from this kind of new lockdown, how do we know they're going to be kept in the future? I mean, obviously the furlough scheme has been extended now to March. Is that an indication that actually normality is going to be nowhere near until March? What do you think?
To be honest, I wondered if it was...
Right, we'll let Laura figure out her microphone. But because it is a very interesting point, is one of the frustrations, and I suppose, and you see this on the Tory bench as well, is how do you get out? Once you go into restrictions, how then do you get out? Like I say, all of us, I mean, Laura less so in Sheffield, we have been under some sort of restrictions, the three of us in Liverpool, Preston and Manchester, for a long, long time. And the mental strain of that is really having an effect now. You can feel it, not only in people being less willing to cooperate with the whole kind of getting tested and social distancing, but people just feeling tired and having a sense of cabin fever. So Laura, what's the way out?
I mean, I think I agree with Lisa that it is, you know, it has to be about the test, trace and isolate system. We're seeing much lower levels of compliance than we were at the beginning. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I think a lot of that is to do with people being just fed up. I also think that a lot of it is, you know, around people just not being able to afford to self-isolate, and we need to be looking at our sick pay settlement. And, you know, without sorting that out, I just don't see how we're going to be able to sort of increase that compliance rate. And ultimately, if people aren't going to self-isolate when they have symptoms, or are going to convince themselves that they don't really have symptoms and then not get tested, then all the lockdowns in the world aren't really going to work and we'll just end up in this position kind of indefinitely. I have to say, when I saw the furlough scheme being extended until March, I mean, my thoughts around it were slightly different in that, given that we know that Rishi Sunak has been so hostile to an extension of the furlough scheme and has been, you know, really pushing back at every opportunity. The fact that he's now willing to go till March, you know, is that an indication that the government thinks that we might have, you know, being able to start rolling out a vaccine over the summer? And, you know, I did wonder if actually that was kind of him sort of accepting that actually maybe there's a different exit strategy. That's perhaps my slightly more optimistic take. But we have seen that we've seen some reports that the Oxford vaccine trial in particular is quite close to being able to unblind its participants. I think they need 75 cases among the participants to be able to unblind who's on the placebo and who's on the real vaccine. And I think after that, we should start to have quite indications quite quickly whether or not it's likely to be an effective vaccine. And, you know, if that's the case, then, you know, we could be seeing as early as the, you know, first months of next year, an initial rollout potentially among key workers to start with. So I think there is a sort of optimistic take, but sadly not an optimistic take that, I mean, it's a we've been rescued by the science optimistic take rather than our government might be starting to sort itself out optimistic take.
But I think the other important thing that will come out in March is, in fact, the sun. And we really do need to get through the winter, because we know, if you remember, that March, when it all started, wasn't that marvellous, sitting in the backyard, the garden. Psychologically, you feel better. The days get longer. You're more likely to go out rather than to stay in. The pavement cafes might be able to start again, whereas at the moment, of course, you don't have them in November and December, certainly not in Liverpool. So getting through the winter is a very important point, even if we don't get the vaccine. But Laura is right. All the points about the vaccine are important. But I just wondered, I don't know whether anyone's done the calculations. Let's say a million people stay on furlough. How much does each of those cost? How much would it cost for the same people to be on benefits? So this isn't either way, there's a lot of people need some element of public support there. And I wondered if the sum say it actually didn't make all that much difference at the end of the day.
Go on, Laura.
I mean, I think the key point, though, is the discrepancy between the generosity of the furlough scheme and the generosity of the benefits system and the sort of vast gap between those two positions. And I think what's really inexcusable with how the government's behaving at this point is that, you know, we still have 3 million people that are excluded. And, you know, in the early, very early stages of the pandemic, you know, I think a lot of people were willing to give them some leeway. John, I know you've been in this position. And, you know, right at the beginning of the pandemic, I think people were willing to give them a reasonable amount of leeway because it was a sort of unprecedented situation. They were trying to scramble to make policy. That's legitimately difficult to do. People's employment patterns are complex. It's genuinely hard. You know, but at this point, it's just, you know, some of these, at least some of those people really could have been helped, you know, sort of limited company directors, people who went self-employed a little while ago, or, you know, also there could have been changes to the benefit system that would have made it at least possible for some of those people to access universal credit. You know, for example, if you're normally self-employed and you know that you're expecting a tax bill, then you could easily have savings that would push you over the limit. And, you know, it's not like you can run those down to live on them, but, you know, in order to get yourself under the limit for UC, because you know you're going to get a tax bill that's not going to go away. So, you know, there are some things that could have been done to, you know, at the very least enable more of those people to be able to access universal credit. There have also been some things around sort of counting how it was counted when people were on maternity leave and how that, you know, affected their ability to access the self-employment support, which, again, you know, we've had a lot of time. They should have been able to figure this stuff out by now. You know, I think in April, fair enough, it was hard. It's November now. You've had months. Get on it.
Yeah, and kind of, I mean, we'll go on to the next section, but again, it kind of segues nicely, is the political fallout from this. And you were talking about the cost of it, and the classic example is that we're going to talk now about free school meals and the disaster that that has been for the government. And it was a strange one. Firstly, it's a strange one for them to dig their heels in. They've done so many U-turns. As soon as anything's even got remotely any traction with the public, they've U-turned on it, generally. And yet they choose this issue to dig their heels in and think, actually, we will stop here. You know, feeding hungry kids is the banner we absolutely will not pass. And it's interesting because you talk about, you know, the help out, eat out to help out scheme. And it worked out to cope with free school meals during the half term would have cost half a day of the eat out to help out, just half a day of it. And it looked like they're not going to cave in ready for Christmas. So I do know, I'm sure community organisations in all your areas are already starting to plan for how they can cope with that. But it's really, the government has really kind of misjudged the tone of this debate. And is now just the fact that the government has just blown any sort of credibility they had for what Laura was saying, is they were dealing with something unprecedented. Now they just look like incompetent idiots.
I think you're right to say they massively misjudged the mood of the nation. And I think there has been a bit of scrambling back from some people who feel their seats may be at risk if people have a memory that lasts three and a bit years to the next election. I think it's a really strange hill to die on for all the reasons you've talked about. I think just the cost of it compared with the other costs that the government is currently incurring, rightly in many cases, is just minuscule compared with the impacts it will have. And I think the cut through it has had. The four of us who are recording this podcast, and anybody listening to this podcast, we've said it before, we're not normal. We pay much, much, much more attention to politics than the vast majority of people. This issue has had cut through with normal people, with people who neither record nor listen to political podcasts. And I think just seeing the amount of people sharing it on social media and the real emotion with which it's been shared has shown why the Tories were wrong to whip their MPs to vote against it.
And do we think the whole, just finishing off the whole lockdown thing, the kind of the showdown with the North, I mean, Laura, obviously you're the chair of the Northern Liberal Network, and, you know, there was a joint statement all of us signed in terms of it, particularly when the row broke out with Andy Burnham. Have the Tories now just thought, again, misjudged the kind of the sentiment of it's all right if it's the North? But I mean, a classic example for me was when suddenly London went into tier two, there was like kind of, oh my word, what are we going to do? We're not going to be able to go to the theatre twice a week. I was like, we've been under that for months, yet London gets it for 2 days. And
you
suddenly
don't go to the theatre in Preston, John. Come on.
I think you'll find there's several nice theatres in Preston, actually. But anyway, but Laura, is that thing of the whole Northern, again, colossally misjudged how it's come across from Northern areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And, you know, I think with something like this, it's hard to know how much it's cutting through. I mean, but, it does look that way. And, you know, I was asked, you know, I went on the radio and I was asked this question, you know, is this a sort of North-South divide thing? And, you know, you don't want to say yes, because you don't want to stir up division. You know, you don't want to give the divisive answer. But it is very striking that in Manchester, the government delayed moving to tier three for the best part of a week, arguing over with Andy Burnham, telling them that it was completely impossible to give him the money for 80% furlough. And then, you know, what was it? A week and a half later, 2 weeks later, that the whole country needs to, you know, cough, cough, London and the southeast needs to go into furlough and needs to go into lockdown. And suddenly 80% furlough is miraculously possible after all. And, you know, it is very difficult to avoid the conclusion that, you know, some people being affected by lockdown matter more than others. And unfortunately, we all live on the wrong side of it. And, you know, this was a government that was elected on a pledge of levelling up. And it, you know, it doesn't look like levelling up. And, you know, I do think as well, there has been a kind of failure to consider why some of these lockdowns might not have been working. And I think, especially when we think about, you know, the areas that have been under additional restrictions for months now, and we saw case numbers sort of keeping rising, you know, what was it that was driving that? And, you know, I do again wonder if one of the things is around the fact the different percentages of jobs that can be done from home. Like, I think in London, 60% of jobs can be done from home, whereas across the north, it's something like 40%. And obviously that will vary hugely. You know, the north is not one place. Well, I mean, it kind of is one place, but it's very, very diverse. And, you know, there'll be sort of very different pictures in different areas. But actually, you know, thinking about, you know, we need to be able to think about sort of different areas and what their needs are and what support they need. And it is extremely striking that the government has been much more generous as soon as London and the South East is involved than they were when the North was involved.
One of the things that worries me about this lockdown is the fact that a lot of people just aren't locking down. So it's not only the ones you can see on the high street, like estate agents that are open. I've had a lot of complaints of companies in Liverpool city centre who are office-based, that's why they're in the city centre, who are making their staff go in, although they were well able to manage at home. So I'm talked to the local paper, and I will be there on Monday looking at the buildings that people are going in to get our enforcement officers in. Not that they can close them down, but they can at least shame them and make sure they are effectively looking after the people they're making to go in. And I've seen an email from one, oh, our premises are safe. Didn't think to ask, and how do people get to our premises and get home again in the evening? So that's why I have concerns about the efficacy of this lockdown. It's too easy to break.
Yeah.
Also, are they really safe? You know, they say that, but are they really? Because one of the things that I think has been really striking for me is just thinking a lot about the kind of evidence and how we deal with defaults. And it's a slightly techie thing, because my husband's a doctor. We spend a lot of time talking about science and evidence and all of that, and also because we're geeks, we spend a lot of time talking about science and evidence and all of this stuff. And I think one of the things that's been really interesting is how the kind of initial assumptions about the disease and how it spread have kind of stuck in policy terms, even as the evidence has evolved. And the kind of, you know, how does your, if once something becomes established as the default, how the weight of evidence that you need to change it just seems to be so huge. So, you know, right at the beginning, there was a very reasonable assumption that it was probably spread through touch contact and surfaces and fomites, which was based on flu. Perfectly reasonable thing to, you know, as a working assumption. Actually, there's now very little evidence for that, and enormous evidence for aerosol transmission. But none of the guidance for COVID secure workplaces have been updated. It's still based on touch transmission, which actually doesn't seem to play as much of a part compared to aerosols. And I mean, I do think there's and let's not divert this into that discussion, because it's fascinating, but, you know, could go on forever. But I do think that there is a point around how our government has been quite slow to react. And actually, to be fair, a lot of governments has been quite slow to react to evidence, and the kind of role that sort of once something becomes the default, it's kind of that kind of incumbency position in sort of policy making that I think perhaps has some kind of wider implications beyond COVID that I've found very, very interesting.
And yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with being a geek. That is, they save the world and make the place a better. Right. So we're talking about being stuck in positions gets us to our next topic, and that's Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, it's interesting enough, the very first time Lisa was on the podcast was just after the Panorama documentary came out on anti-Semitism in Labour. And me and Lisa had a long old conversation about how grim, I think was the word you used, Lisa, in that episode, that documentary was. And the report that came out was the Equalities and Human Rights report was utterly, did anyone expect it to be that cutthroat in terms of how bad it was for Labour? And it wasn't just a couple of individuals. There were 23 cases that went to that the leader's office deliberately got involved in. And then obviously to make matters worse, Corbyn then downplayed it that morning. I mean, did it? I mean, Lisa, did he leave Keir Starmer any choice whatsoever?
No. I think one of the things to note, though, is that it was the Labour General Secretary who I think actually issued the suspension rather than the leader. Yeah. It wasn't Keir Starmer, but clearly... But
you can imagine, you can't imagine Keir Starmer not being in that conversation.
I think the only thing I feel it's appropriate to say about this from my perspective is that Luciana Berger has the grace and class in her little finger that I think many of us could only aspire to. I think she conducted herself in the press. Lots of the press were really interested to talk to her over the days that that came out, and she conducted herself with grace and class in a way that she should be very proud of.
And I hope she stays with us.
Indeed.
I mean, you might not feel in a position to talk about it, Lisa, but I just think Corbyn could not have been more stupid. I mean, having such a tin ear to it, honestly, it just, the arrogance of the man. I mean, everyone, all these kind of far left lovies who think, you know, who thinks he's the savior, he just couldn't back down. He could not back down from where he was to the point where, and now all this, like Keir Starmer could have, and the Labour leadership could have easily moved on from it. That was a starting new leadership, put it to bed, and he has to dig his heels in. I mean, Richard, you've got Corbynista MPs in Liverpool. I think you've got four of them. And what, I mean, I don't know where Labour goes with it now. I mean, Keir Starmer, I think, has come out of it well. But I mean, in some ways, Jeremy Corbyn's probably helped him kind of from an election point of view in doing that. Keir Starmer seems like, well, I've proper put it to bed. The party has suspended Jeremy Corbyn. So what's your view on it, Richard, as our chief Labour kind of facing person here?
Right. Well, the problem that Labour have got is, of course, that many Corbynistas are now entrenched in places, not only the four members of Parliament, but also as councillors. Now, as the council doesn't meet all that much, and it's a mayoral system anyway, what they can do within the council is fairly limited. But it is quite apparent that they are spending a lot of time fighting each other. At the moment. So it's a time, for the right reasons, we're working very closely with the Labour mayor on the finances of the council and the coronavirus. They're attacking him. In fact, they attack him more than they attack me, which bothers neither him nor me. What I don't know yet is how the Labour Party will move in Liverpool, because after the militant time, which is very, very similar, a lot of people just didn't go back into the Labour Party. Once you've been harangued for 2 years, you find something else, and you find you really like doing macrame or something, anything. You take up amateur dramatics. And once you do other things, do you go back? And I think a lot of the good people who left, didn't come to us, they just left, won't go back. So Labour are going to lose their momentum Turks who went delivering for them, but they've also lost some of their solid ward organisers, the sergeants who keep the party running.
And what the general election, Laura, you can finish off this point, showed that for all momentum's bluster, they're not exactly great at winning elections, are they? You know, a bunch of banner wavers, they're not doing the graft.
I mean, to be fair to them, actually, during the election, they do show up in numbers. And I mean, we certainly saw that in Sheffield, the kind of momentum candidates were able to kind of generate large numbers of people. But ultimately, if you've got a message that people don't want to buy, then all of the doorstep campaigning in the world isn't going to win you an election. And I think that's where they fell down, is that they had a shonky product. I do think that Jeremy Corbyn's comments, actually, I think I disagree with you. I think that Jeremy Corbyn's comments actually, to an extent, let Keir Starmer off the hook, because all of the questions in that press conference were, are you going to suspend Jeremy Corbyn? To which his answer was a perfect, you know, well, we've literally got a report that says that the leadership shouldn't be interfering in this kind of thing. So no, I'm not going to suspend Jeremy Corbyn, but the General Secretary may well coincidentally do it, you know, just after this ends. And I think had that not been the case, the questions would have been, well, all of this has been laid out in detail in the report. Throughout this time, you were standing next to Jeremy Corbyn in the shadow cabinet, advocating for him to be prime minister. You know, how much did you know? Do you have anything to say about that? And those questions haven't been asked. And I think had the story not been Jeremy Corbyn, I think they probably would have been asked. And I think they should be asked. And I mean, I think that Keir Starmer, you know, I like Keir Starmer, actually, and he's done a lot of the right things on this. But I was genuinely disappointed that his apology was solely on behalf of the Labour Party, and that there didn't seem to be any kind of personal sense of responsibility and culpability in his statement. And actually, you know what, like, he was a big part of the shadow cabinet, and he did advocate to make somebody who we now know was presiding over an appalling internal culture of anti-Semitism, and tried to make that guy prime minister. And he must have known that he was completely unfit for the job. And I think that that is something that we should be asking questions about. And I also think that it has to be a wake-up call for the political system as a whole. I think that obviously, as bad as it got in Labour, because somebody who had these appalling views got to the top of the party, you know, that it got really, really bad in Labour. But I also think that there is a kind of wider, you know, potentially wider culture of anti-Semitism in politics that we need to think about. I was very, very struck. Do you guys remember a few weeks ago, or maybe even a couple of months now, you know, who's lost track of time? There was this that Tory MP's wife who brought out those diaries of the Cameron years, Sasha Swire. And it was only when the Jewish Chronicle did a review that they kind of pointed out that there were really quite a lot of anti-Semitic comments in them. And I think at that point, I'd read four or five reviews of this book, whole load of Twitter threads, and no one had noticed the anti-Semitism. And it just really felt like, for me, it was just a little bit of a wake-up call, like, combined with this Labour report, that, like, actually there's a lot of this out there in politics, and we have to make sure that we care about it all the time, not only when it's, you know, obviously if there's a risk that somebody who holds anti-Semitic views is going to become prime minister, then that is more important than if some random Tory MP's wife has these views. Like, that's still bad, but it's not as bad as the potential prime minister. But actually, we should care about racism all the time. And I don't know. I it just made me realize that I think, you know, on anti-Semitism, and I will very rarely say this, but, you know, there was a shadow of a point that the Corbynites had when they said that people were only talking about it when it was in Labour and when it was Corbyn. And actually, we need to talk about it more. And even in our own party, we allowed somebody who had anti-Semitic views to get on the shortlist for London mayoralty. And yes, the disciplinary action was taken very, very quickly. And I think I was hugely impressed by how quickly they acted. But actually, we also need to be looking at how we allowed somebody to get to that point in the first place, and asking ourselves those questions, because we can always do better.
So, agreeing with Laura strongly there, just to reassure people that work is going on behind the scenes. The really glamorous part of the party is working on how to stop that stuff from happening again. And I think the London mayoral candidate was a terrible example, but a very good illustration of some of the problems with the system. And I agree with you, Laura, about the swiftness of the response when some of that came to light more obviously was good and welcome, but it shouldn't have been allowed to happen to begin with. And so more robustness is being put in the process, and there's a good team of volunteers working on how to make that better for the party, because you're right, it's not acceptable. We should be alert to it all the time, not just when it's one of our opposition parties who is in the spotlight for it, but yeah, the party behind the scenes is working on trying to stop that really awful stuff from happening again.
And I think there are certain points which we should be more aware of. I mean, I had to go back on the parliamentary list because I wanted to be the mayor I want to be the candidate for the mayor of Liverpool, and I wasn't particularly challenged by the day, but I've been in the party a long time, so I've got a track record and people can check what I've said. But when people join us from another party, as this case was in London, surely we do treble checks or whatever. There's got to be an extra element of inquiry into people like that.
Yeah, and
perhaps
I think
it should be more into me for that matter.
And I think what really, I do apologise, the bangs are, I have fireworks going off outside the house. The dog is being very well behaved and not barking though, so that's a thing. But I think what doomed Labour really, it was the systemic nature of how they didn't deal with them. In fact, and actually, you know, for as much as a political party can try, there will always be an idiot who sneaks through.
Yes.
But it's then how you deal with how you deal with those idiots once it comes to light is the test of the party, really. But yeah, so brilliant that processes have gone on. We've only got a few minutes left to talk about another huge story. I mean, there's been so much going on, and we haven't even talked about Brexit yet, and where Britain is heading with that. Again, it just seems like a complete farce in terms of that whole, you know, well, don't, when the government said, well, there's no point in coming to Britain because the deal's off. The deal is off. And then it turns out a week later, actually, can you just do it? We want to do it quietly. It's just chaos. Does anyone think we're going to get a deal at all? Or do you think it'll be kind of a deal in like kind of name only, just to kind of save face? What are people's impressions on this?
I think the second one, deal in name only, is probably, I mean, I don't know, like, who knows, but that would be my best guess. I mean, I think the other story about the furlough scheme is that, you know, the extension to March does very conveniently cover the immediate aftermath of the Brexit period. So, I feel like that's not a complete coincidence. It's really scary times because we are in an incredibly fragile situation, and like economically and in terms of, you know, our healthcare and all of this, lots and lots of people have lost their jobs. Lots and lots of people are in a very kind of economically vulnerable situation at the moment, and Brexit is only going to make it worse. You know, I think none of us here will disagree that Brexit was the wrong thing to happen, that we all opposed it. But if we were going to do it, this is the worst possible time.
There's a situation in Liverpool. I serve on this arcane body called the Merseyside Port Health Authority. And they're anticipating that the number of checks they ought to be doing on incoming food and similar products will go up from 1,900 to 21,000. There's a slight problem with that. They haven't got the staff or the money to do anything like that number. So they've got the alternatives of turning things away or letting them through without being checked. And I think at the moment the pressure will be on to let them through without being checked. The other consequence in Liverpool is that the hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic will start in Birkenhead, because that's where the ferries go. And at the moment, they're serviced by one set of people from one terminal, no problems. And now there's going to be a lot more segregation and a lot more cost. So I can remember just people telling me I was lying when I said that there'll be a hard border just across the river. I said I was lying when there are going to be problems for Jaguar Land Rover. We weren't. And if we see the opinion polls now, do you think we should go? Do you regret it? Heavily now in favour of Remain. But that still doesn't mean it's time for us to say rejoined tomorrow.
I agree with Richard. I think one of the things that we've talked about quite a bit on the pod and elsewhere is about the poor quality of comms from the government around coronavirus and how to respond to it. One of the things that the government has clearly been putting lots of money into is this Get Ready for Brexit campaign, its comms campaign. Go to the website, you need to take action now. And it has this ticking noise and this increasingly energetic, you must get something done, radio adverts, TV adverts. And how, get ready how. It says if you deal at all with Europe, you need to get ready, but has no instruction on how to get ready because they don't know what the deal will look like. I agree with Laura. I think there will be a deal. I think it'll be the sort of deal you probably could write on the back of a fag packet, but they'll stash it out with, they'll fill it out to make it look wonderful. Boris Johnson will hail it as the deal of the century, and he did everything that he wanted to deliver. But we just need to have a few follow-up calls to flesh out some of the detail on some other things. So I think there will be a deal, but it'll be crap.
Yeah, it's looking, and like I said, if you were to do it, would you do it now? It's just horrendous. We're coming to the end of this episode. A couple of points I want to make just for all our listeners and viewers is, firstly, we do know there's a lot of stuff happening in Scotland at the moment, particularly with Nicola Sturgeon and everything to do with the fallout from Alex Salmon. So we are trying to get some Scottish guests together. We will do a specialist Scottish episode like we did with a Welsh episode. And that leads me finally to a huge heartfelt thanks, I think, from all of us would go to Kirsty Williams, who has announced she will not be standing next year, who has been such a brilliant advocate for liberalism in Wales and in Britain. And, you know, me and Laura had the pleasure of interviewing her just a few weeks ago. I don't know if that's what broke her, Laura. She was, and this is absolutely no joke, me and Laura came off that interview and immediately started WhatsApping each other saying how utterly brilliant and amazing she was, and a really inspirational figure. So, just enjoy your retirement, I suppose, Kirsty. And, you know, and she really, really thanks from all of us. I don't know if anyone else got anything to add to that.
I think the one thing I'd add is just to say, Kirsty is a cracking example of why we need to get Lib Dems elected. Just the record of delivery Kirsty has, both as an Assembly member and then more recently as Education Minister, I think just underlines the point that lots of us bang on about, is that this stuff really matters, that actually getting Lib Dems elected changes the lives of people in our communities and in Kirsty's responsibilities, an entire nation, for the better. And so, you know, deliver the leaflets, people.
Perhaps another lesson we ought to pick up that perhaps Lisa and Laura won't mention, but I will, is that there wasn't only Kirsty, there was a cracking interview with a first-class Liberal in Northern Ireland, Naomi Long. And I think that perhaps the time is coming for women to take over from stale old men like me. So that's just a little encouragement to you both. Sorry about that, John.
Although you will have to go to the Merseyside Port Authority meetings or whatever it is. So just before you say yes, I just want to put that caveat in. You know, it's a very long list.
It didn't apply to Liverpool, John. I'm talking generally around here. I decide what goes on, laddie.
I'll take the Port Authority and I'll raise you the Greater Manchester Waste Disposal Authority.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, I do have a small, because I mean, our interview with Kirsty Williams was just like inspirational, just absolutely incredible. Like, you know, I thought I was a Kirsty Williams fan before, but like the list of achievements that she just reeled off, it was just like, wow, where did half of those come from? I have to confess, I'm holding out a small sliver of hope that perhaps she's retiring from the Senate because she's decided she wants to fling herself into national politics and, you know. But it's a small sliver, and please don't shatter my dreams until at least next week.
Okay.
She's just amazing. I hope she stays active in the party at the very least.
Well, and on that note of thanks to Kirsty Williams, as fireworks go off, thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Laura. That was the news this week. I don't know what we're going to have next week. You seem to have major events going on every couple of days, but we also have some brilliant episodes coming up and other episodes lined up as well. So do subscribe to the podcast on wherever you get your podcasts, or on YouTube, or you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Lib Dem Pod. Do follow all these guys as well. They're an absolute font of information and joy on social media as well. Thank you so much for listening. Do stay safe out there. Do go out and still deliver leaflets. Don't hunker down, as the party has said. You know, those May elections are just around the corner. And if no one else is going to be delivering, we can be, because, you know, we can't stop campaigning. We have to keep going. But thank you very much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.